Hey, Modern Minds listener. This episode is going to be dealing with medication, and there's two physicians on the show. So given that, this is a reminder up front that Modern Minds is about education and awareness. It's about discussion and debate on modern issues in mental health care. Nothing that you hear today should be understood as medical advice. If you're considering adding, changing, or stopping any medication, please discuss it with your healthcare provider. Thank you.
I'm Mark Hennick. Today I'm going to be talking about deprescribing with Dr. Mark Horowitz and Dr. Christy Huff. For the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network, this is Modern Minds. Welcome to Modern Minds, I'm Mark Hennick. Today on the show, we're talking about deprescribing in mental health care. For some, medications can play a crucial role in managing a variety of mental health conditions and in improving their quality of life. However, as our understanding of these medications advances, so too does our knowledge of the potential harms and risks associated with certain drugs. Today, we're going to be delving into the art and the science of deprescribing. This is the process of thoughtfully reducing or discontinuing medications that might no longer be necessary. They might even be causing harm. Joining us today are two brilliant minds who have been at the forefront of this movement. First, we have Dr. Mark Horowitz. He's a renowned training psychiatrist and a leading expert in deprescribing practices. I'm also going to speak with Dr. Christy Huff. She's a cardiologist and a passionate patient advocate. Dr. Huff has witnessed firsthand the impact of overprescribing and the importance of empowering patients to take control of their healthcare decisions. She brings, I think, a unique perspective to our discussion today, shedding light on the patient experience in the deprescribing process. So let's jump right in. Here's my conversation with Dr. Mark Horowitz. Thank you so much for joining me on Modern Minds today, Dr. Horowitz.
Thanks for having me on here. Great to speak to you.
So we're talking about deprescribing in, and specifically in psychiatry and mental health. I'm going to get you to unpack that for us as we go along. But first, I want to think about just how things are right now. You know, deprescribing assumes prescribing. Antidepressants are among the most widely prescribed medications in the world, as are other agents in this space. So what's your perception right now on treatment as usual? How does treatment of mental illness usually go?
You know, mental illness is obviously a very wide category that stretches from common anxiety and depression all the way to what could see as more serious mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. In general, the treatment of all mental health conditions is currently very medicalized, which is it's a process of fitting someone's symptoms to a diagnosis and then giving them the appropriate medications. Of course, therapy and other non-medication treatments are given alongside that, but it's become predominantly a medicalized field, a field where medications are used primarily. When you understand, for example, anxiety and depression occurs in about 70% of people in their up until the age of 45, it's a very common condition. And so rather than seeing it as a medical illness that requires specific medication, it might be better seen as a fairly normal part of people's lives and treated in a less medicalized way. But that aside, it is now treated in a highly medicalized way. In the US, one in four people are on an antidepressant. About one in six or seven are on a benzodiazepine or sleeping tablet. In Europe and in England, one in four people are on some sort of psychiatric medication. So psychiatric medications are now prescribed very widely and they're increasing every year.
Now that biomedical model of mental illness, it's, as you mentioned, certainly the prevailing one in America and elsewhere. It's this materialist or physicalist view that problems of the mind are problems of the body. It kind of collapses the difference between them. And I think it's probably this determinism too, maybe not to get too philosophical, that problems can and should be defined and fixed. So I'd like to challenge you maybe a little bit, but do you think there's any benefits of that medical lens on mental illness? We'll get to the drawbacks, but do you think that there's been any benefits?
Look, it's a huge area of debate. I mean, I'm not suggesting dualism or that the mind and the brain have nothing to do with one another. I think it's a sort of truism to say that everything that happens in the mind occurs in the brain. I guess the contention in the field is that the best level at which to understand things? So, one approach to understanding depressed mood would be to look in the brain at what part of the brain is more active during depressed mood. And that is where a lot of money has been put to look at what are the neural basis of depressed mood. Another way to think about it would be what are the circumstances in someone's life that has led them to be hopeless, demoralized, or suicidal. And that is a very different approach. To some degree, all approaches may have some validity, but the last 50 years of research in the field of anxiety and depression has produced no concrete findings that have helped us to forward how we treat anxiety and depression. One perspective would be that we're looking in the wrong place. An analogy, hackneyed as it might be, it could be that in trying to fix a software issue, we're looking at the hardware. So that if someone has an issue with Microsoft Word, if someone came along and opened up the back of your computer to start soldering the circuits, you might think that was a bit peculiar. But that is currently what we're doing in the field of psychiatry. I think we're mistaking things in people's minds and in their lives. What is going on?
So, I mean, beyond the sort of academic debate there, what are the real world implications or drawbacks, do you think, as it affects people who are suffering and the patients of that kind of model?
So I think it can be unnecessarily pathologizing, and I think it can be stigmatizing, and I think it can lead to worse outcomes. So it's often said that giving people biological explanations of what's going on with their emotions is destigmatizing. That if you tell people there's something wrong with their brain, it's not their fault, that you're making life easier for them. But there's another side to that, because if you tell somebody that the reason why they're feeling demoralized, hopeless, or suicidal is because there's something wrong with their brain that we haven't quite worked out yet, but research may one day work it out. You're telling them that they essentially have a broken brain of some sort. It is often experienced as a relief in the short-term diagnoses. And in the long term, it can become a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, because people are less inclined to rely on themselves, or less inclined to think they can make changes that will affect their health, because they're told that there is something organically wrong with them. And that implies that medical interventions are the most sensible thing. So I think that telling people that they've got a condition like major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder, rather than explaining to them that they're demoralized because various social relationships in their life are unfulfilling or they're under certain stresses, can in the long term lead to worse outcomes and people internalizing a negative and broken image of themselves. That's the all-time clinical practice.
Now, I mean, billions of dollars of research have been spent, especially, and it seems like it's increasing in recent years, has been spent on basic research in the physiology and the neuroscience of mental illness, as well as in the social sciences and on social determinants of mental health. But I heard you say just a minute ago that we haven't made a whole lot of headway. We haven't produced a lot from that research. Can you talk more about that?
So you don't need to take my word for it. You could take the word of Thomas Insel, who was the head of the National Institute for Mental Health Research in America, who said that after spending tens of billions of dollars on research into mental illness, they hadn't moved the dial at all in helping patients. They, in his words, had produced some cool science on genetics and imaging, but nothing of practical significance to patients on the ground. And I think that is, in general, the sum total of the neuroscience research that's occurred for the last few decades. It hasn't had any practical improvement in the lives of people suffering from conditions. And I think that comes down to that what I would see as a fundamental category error, mistaking issues in the mind and people's lives for issues in their brains. There's an incredibly clear relationship between stresses in people's lives, poverty, relationship discord, physical illness, and the rates of depression and anxiety. Or it is very clear from research that it's conditions in people's lives that lead to feel depressed and demoralized and suicidal. And I think it makes the most sense to deal with those conditions, hard as that might be, rather than looking further for some corner of the brain that we can tweak with a medication or with electricity or to fix issues in people's lives.
There's been such an increase in mental health awareness and campaigns, celebrities, governments are talking, just in the last probably 10 years or so, mental health has reached sort of a bubble of sorts in terms of awareness. But I've also noticed that there's a certain central dogma of so many of these campaigns and conversations, which comes back to what we're talking about, that the idea that mental illnesses are brain illnesses, that depression is just like cancer, that collapsing of the difference. And I think the goal is probably a noble one. It's to lend legitimacy to mental health by hitching it to something that's seen as more legitimate, physical health. Is that particularly helpful, though, or could that be harming people who are struggling to try to reduce it that way?
I agree with you. I think a lot of this comes from probably good intentions, that it will lead to less stigma for patients if you tell them it's a brain condition, it's not their fault. I also think it stems a bit from the interests of drug companies, who in convincing us that we have neurochemical problems makes us more likely to become customers for neurochemical solutions. I think that it can be damaging for people to be told that the very common, often very understandable emotions that they experience are actually illnesses, because one thing it teaches us is to be afraid of our emotions. As I said earlier on, actually, by the age of 45, 86% of people will meet criteria for mental illness. 70% of people will meet criteria for anxiety and depressive conditions. So these are very common conditions in life. When we are overwhelmed by demands in life, we become depressed. When we feel very insecure about the future, we become anxious. So these are very common conditions. I just think of a report in England at the end of last year saying that there was a spike in mental health conditions amongst young people, and it was associated with poverty and bullying. And the response to that was for there to be more research into what is causing mental illness and how we can best treat it, which I sort of think of as an absurd response. That can exist in a society that's sort of been seized by a neuromania, where the brain and technology offers so much promise to understanding these things, because obviously you would respond to that by saying poverty and bullying are causing people to become depressed. We need to address bullying, not to turn to understanding the brains of people who are depressed in those circumstances. We would all become depressed in circumstances of oppression. And so I think that there has been this reductive focus on the brain, and a look to technology for explaining what is going on has turned us away from the more intuitive, obvious, humanistic explanations for what is going on. And I think it has distracted us from what the real solution is.
And redirecting resources as well, right? I mean, if there's a bullying problem, and as we know, hard things are hard. Hard things are supposed to be hard. Of course, you would react in an adaptive way to that. So then to fund something that isn't focused on the core problem seems like a misdirection of resources.
I agree. There's been a huge expenditure in the Western world into, research on genetics and neuroscience to make sense of psychiatry, and it's all very interesting. And I've did my PhD in that topic, and I understand why people are so fascinated by it, as I was, because there's this promise that we could understand what is under the hood and causing emotional problems. It's very appealing. But I think that we have spent large amounts of money that hasn't returned any of the people on the ground sometimes I've had people say to me that it's utopic to think about solving issues like poverty and bullying, which are widespread. But I think unless we are honest about what is causing the problems that we're experiencing, we have no hope of solving them. So it may well be that equality and bullying are very difficult issues to manage. But if we pretend that the issues exist in the amygdala and hippocampus and not in schools and now societies, then I think we are being directed towards solutions that are not really the ones that they're gonna have the most benefit.
Let's drill back to the medication piece specifically, because I imagine people who are listening or watching might be thinking, well, what's this have to do with de-prescribing? But I think it's important background cultural context of why somebody would want to de-prescribe in the first place and how we got to the place where maybe they're prescribed. So let's talk a little bit first about the efficacy of medications in psychiatry in general. It seems like we have more antidepressant prescriptions, for example, than ever before, but people are also more depressed than ever before. The numbers seem to be going up, not down. Can you help us make sense of that?
Yeah, so it's a great point. So when you think about deprescribing, so one, you've got it on the background of what I've just outlined, which is several decades where the medical model of mental health conditions has been predominant. It's led to widespread prescribing. Many people would argue gross overprescribing, where now one in four or more people in Western countries are on a psychiatric drug. And so deprescribing, which didn't come from psychiatry in the first place, it came actually from geriatric medicine, is the idea of rationalizing overprescribing because medications can, in some cases, cause more harm than good. And deprescribing is simplifying people's medication regimes in order to address those harms. When it comes to antidepressants in particular, you've made a very astute observation that other people have also made, which is if antidepressants were very effective for anxiety and depression, then how come we have rising rates of anxiety and depression? When an effective drug like insulin was introduced into medical practice, amputation of diabetic limbs went down. It would be very peculiar if alongside the introduction of an effective medication, amputations of diabetic limbs went up. And so you're right to ask the question, are these drugs effective? And the science on this issue is in my view, quite clear. There have been about 1,000 studies on antidepressant effectiveness where they compare an antidepressant to a sugar tablet. In these studies, they show that antidepressants are better than sugar tablets by about 2 points on a 52-point depression scale, a very, very small difference. There are a few reasons why even that difference is probably exaggerated. People who are given antidepressants are unblinded in these studies. They know that they're on a medication because of the side effects. When people know they're on a medication, it leads to expectation effects that they'll get better. That may make people on medication show improvements that are not due to the medication, but due to their thoughts about the medication. The studies are extremely short-term. 97% of these studies are conducted by the drug companies that are selling the drugs. They go for normally 6 to 12 weeks. We know that people in America, most of them on antidepressants, are taking them for more than 5 years. In England and Europe, it's more than 2 years. We know that medications tend to wear off over time, what's called tolerance. And so these small effects, if they are real at 6 weeks, are very likely to wear off over time. We know that's very true, particularly for drugs that cause withdrawal symptoms. And antidepressants are becoming increasingly recognized to be cause withdrawal symptoms in lots of people. There's also an issue with publication bias when it comes to antidepressants. We know that most trials are not published. Drug companies are not compelled to publish all the trials that they've conducted. When you look at trials that haven't been published, most of them are negative. That is, they show no difference between sugar pills and antidepressants. So there's a wide variety of reasons to think that antidepressants are not very effective. And even the biggest booster of antidepressants will admit they have small effects. But there's now an increasing group of psychiatrists and researchers who think they have no significant difference from sugar tablets in terms of having a clinically important difference. So, that's one concept probably to get across, which is For example, if you show that a diet pill is better than a placebo, but it only causes you to lose 50 grams of weight, it's not thought to be a clinically important difference. And that is probably true for antidepressants. Before we get into the whole host of side effects or adverse effects that the drugs can cause.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that there's more than 1,000 studies. You talked about how underwhelming the evidence is, the methodological issue, certainly. But, you know, if you, this is never a good guide, but if you turn to the conversation on social media, it seems like there's still a stigma against leveling this kind of legitimate scientific criticism against the medical model, against treatment as usual. You know, you get accused of being anti-psychiatrist or a Scientologist or even anti-science. You get accused of pill shaming, all this stuff. What do you make of that social aspect of this conversation? Why does that happen if the evidence is seemingly so clear?
You're right. Discussion about psychiatric medications becomes very, very emotive very quickly. It's very hard to have a rational discussion about it. I think this is for a variety of reasons. Number one, started with drug companies and the academics that work with them in trying to discredit critics of their products. They would use this slur of being a Scientologist or an anti-psychiatrist, which is a way to distract from a discussion of the benefits and harms of medications, which is a completely normal part of medical and scientific work. That's what doctors and medical researchers do in every specialty of medicine. Is this treatment more harmful or more beneficial than another treatment? It's a way of silencing critics. It used to be done, it's very reminiscent of what has been done in the climate change space, where people who would point out the effects of fossil fuels on climate change, used to be dismissed as communists or anti-corporate actors, rather than considering the scientific facts they were putting forward. It's a similar kind of approach taken by drug companies and their supporters. It's also become mixed up in identity politics, where many people have been told they have a mental illness. They've incorporated that into their identity. I understand that very well because I've been exactly in that position. I've done the same thing. It's a way that people make sense of their lives and make sense of the distress they've been through. And criticizing medication is tied into criticizing the legitimacy of people's suffering, which I think is a very false connection. It's been called the false brain or blame dichotomy. If you're criticizing the effectiveness of medication, you're thought to be criticizing the reality of people's mental health condition, and therefore blaming them for being weak or something else discriminatory. Well, I would argue that's not really what's happening here. Now, I think people respond to depression and stress in their environments in an understandable way that requires support and merits assistance. And criticizing medication, looking at its harms and its benefits, is not an ideological process seeking to stigmatize people, but doing something that's a very core part of being a doctor or a scientist, which is looking at the evidence on either side. And it's very unfortunate it's become so emotive a topic and people cannot discuss it, work out what is best for people.
We're going to have much more with Dr. Mark Horowitz in just a few minutes, including on a protocol for how to deprescribe. But first, I want to break away because I want you to hear from Dr. Christy Huff. Dr. Huff is a doctor and a patient, and she's been a thought leader in the mindful prescribing and deprescribing of benzodiazepines. So here's my conversation with Dr. Huff on Modern Minds. Christy, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking on this episode about the idea of deprescribing. And what I'm interested about your background and your history is that, like I mentioned, you're a cardiologist, you're focusing on benzodiazepines. That for me isn't an immediately apparent connection. Usually that's a conversation that's had in psychiatry or psychology. So can you tell me a bit more about your background, your interest as a cardiologist and as just a person in benzodiazepines in particular?
Sure. So actually, I have lived experience with benzodiazepines. I was prescribed them to deal with a health crisis I was experiencing back in 2015. And I became physically dependent pretty quickly on them, even though I didn't take more than prescribed. And it took me over 3 years to taper off the medication, and it proved to be extremely difficult. And even 4 years later, after completely being free of the benzodiazepine, I am, still suffering some protracted symptoms. And so during that whole experience, it just led me to realize how little training we as physicians receive on these medications, and specifically how difficult they can be to come off of and how to properly deprescribe them. And so that's, and I started talking to other patients that were experiencing the same thing. And that's how I became involved in this advocacy.
And I'm sure you've heard that it's quite common. Now, we have a lot of physicians who watch and listen to this show, but if they're either not involved in benzo prescribing, or for other people who are listening who might not know exactly what these compounds are, can you tell us a little bit more about what benzodiazepines are? What are the indications, the contraindications? How are these employed in clinical settings?
Yeah, so benzodiazepines are considered to be sedatives or minor tranquilizers. They go by such familiar names as Xanax or Valium. And they're most often prescribed for things like anxiety and insomnia. They they bind the GABA receptor, and they enhance the activity of GABA, which is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the nervous system.
So I'm curious then about the safe prescribing of that. I know you had an adverse reaction, but, do you think that there is a role for benzodiazepine prescribing?
Yeah, there definitely is. They are meant to be for short-term use. That's what most of the guidelines say. And if you look at the FDA prescribing information, they say the best way to use them is the shortest duration possible at the lowest dose. So really just try to minimize that use and only use as needed. It's always good to look for, alternatives. But they are very useful in things like they're used in an emergency setting to abort an acute seizure. They're used for alcohol withdrawal to prevent a seizure. They may be used to taper off of a benzodiazepine. So there's definitely uses for them in clinical practice.
But it sounds like not many medications are a set it and forget it kind of thing, but it's not supposed to be a chronic treatment or an ongoing treatment, it sounds like.
Right. Long-term use is generally not recommended because there are adverse effects, and then their efficacy tends to wane over time.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So what are some of those adverse effects that either you experienced or that you've heard of others experiencing?
Yeah. So obviously physical dependence is going to be a big one. So basically the brain and body adapt to being on the medication. And then once you stop it, you get withdrawal symptoms. And in addition, they can be sedating. They can cause dizziness. They've been associated with increased accidents, fractures and falls and things like that.
So then how can we better educate physicians who very often are having, I think anyway, patients come to them because they've seen a television commercial, for example, for a medication that ends up being a benzodiazepine, and that person comes in asking for it. Maybe they're experiencing acute anxiety. It's really interfering with their life. It seems like an entirely reasonable request to go to your doctor and ask for help with that. So then how can we better educate physicians on alternative treatments or at least appropriate use of these medications?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, most of the benzodiazepines are generic at this point, so you're probably not going to see a television commercial for them nowadays just because it's not lucrative, I guess, for the drug companies at this point since they're mostly generic. But patients do often come in and ask their doctor for these things because they've been around for years. I mean, and they're very well ingrained in popular culture. It's like, oh, just you watch a movie and they're like, oh, just pop a Xanax. Like, it's no big deal. And so the education piece is something that we have really been working on at my organization. And, I've been presenting a lot recently at different medical conferences. And we're working with this group out of Colorado. Then we produce some guidance documents for deprescribing. And then also several members of our organization are on a patient panel sharing our lived experience with the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And they're working on it under a grant from the FDA to generate some deprescribing guidelines for benzodiazepines. And that's a couple of years out, but that's an exciting project.
Mm. I've heard more than once, particularly with benzodiazepines, that you can do a great job of educating, you know, say that person's family doctor or whoever their primary caregiver, primary physician is. But since they can be habit forming, that patient might just go to a different doctor. Have there been any strategies to address that issue of double doctoring of dependency that can arise with the use of these kinds of medications?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think most states have implemented something called a PDMP or prescription monitoring database. And so physicians are able to log in and check and see exactly what prescriptions patients are filling that are also controlled substances. So that's a way of, you know, preventing that doctor shopping, basically.
Mm. It's also not uncommon, particularly in psychiatry. I experienced this myself as a person with lived experience, to be prescribed many different things at once. And it seems like, this is just anecdotal, but it seems like benzodiazepines are often, you know, a part of that cocktail of medications, along with antidepressants, sometimes antipsychotics, and a number of things. What are the kinds of drug interactions that we might look for with benzodiazepines in particular, either working complementing or I suspect working against other drugs that somebody might be prescribed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. They're very notable for interacting with opioids. And in fact, the FDA came out with a box warning back in 2016 cautioning against that combination, because anytime you combine two things that cause respiratory depression, that can lead to overdose and even death. So it's also dangerous to combine benzodiazepines actually with any other sedating medication or like alcohol and things like that.
That's fascinating, the piece about opioids, because, you know, since we've heard certainly many times that we're in an opioid crisis right now, it seems, depending on who you ask, particularly with overdoses. So that's not something that I was aware of. Now, I know that, you know, you've practiced cardiology, and this is maybe more of a psychology, psychotherapy type question, but anxiety disorders seem to be best treated through psychotherapy, through relearning how to encounter or regulate your response to the world around you, even in cases of trauma and PTSD. And I've heard it said that sometimes medications which reduce that anxiety almost artificially, like benzodiazepines or sedatives can do, actually can get in the way of treating the underlying cause, that you're not learning anything, that you're treating the symptom and not the core cause of what's making you feel that way to begin with. How does that fit with your understanding of why benzos might be prescribed and how we can perhaps treat the underlying cause better?
Yeah, that's definitely true. Again, they're mainly effective in the short term, and then over time you can get tolerance. And actually, people can end up with worsening anxiety. We call it benzodiazepine-induced hyperanxiogenesis, which is kind of a mouthful. But people can actually end up with worse anxiety than before they even started the benzodiazepine. So that's something to caution. I mean, I think they're probably best used maybe just like kind of a one-off dose to prevent a panic attack, maybe somebody who has fear of flying, something like that. And or sometimes they're used as a kind of a bridge to therapy. So if somebody's in an acute crisis and you're just giving it to them short term before they get psychotherapy or counseling and these other modalities that can be effective.
Mm. Part of, I think, this whole mix is the role of patient self-advocacy, of people speaking up when they're experiencing adverse effects and or something just doesn't feel right. And, you know, if I'm off base here, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've been maybe a very effective self-advocate because you have an MD after your name too, right? You know what you're talking about. Yeah, this isn't your first rodeo. For other patients, I'm not sure that's always the case. You know, we've heard many times they sit in front of their doctor, they tell them that the medication makes them feel awful. And then the doctor either doesn't do anything or kind of dismisses that concern, places themselves as more experienced and more knowledgeable. So what are your recommendations for people in being effective self-advocates if they're on benzos or anything else and want to talk to their doctor about whether or not it's working for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, even as a physician, I still ran into a lot of pushback when I started having problems. So I can imagine that patients without a medical education, it would be even worse because I experienced that disbelief and lack of validation. But I would recommend that people do their research before coming to the doctor and just get educated about this issue. Like I printed out a copy of the Ashton Manual to take to my doctor. And I went through a couple of different doctors before I found somebody that was willing to work with me. And then really it's just about finding that physician that's going to be willing to take a patient-centered approach and validate what you're experiencing. And sometimes that's kind of a trial and error process.
Mm. Now, the last piece of this, of course, if you do, you and your doctor together, because I assume you're going to, well, actually, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't make any assumptions here, but I suppose it's wise to talk to your doctor and not just do it yourself, right? This isn't a DIY job to deprescribe, is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question because we do have patients in the online support communities who are doing the DIY thing just out of necessity because they've had trouble finding a doctor that's willing to work with them. But yes, in the ideal world, you would have a doctor who's patient-centered and willing to learn about this issue, and then the patient is working with them and, you know, letting them know, you know, exactly what's going on symptom-wise. But again, that's in an ideal world, and that's not always what happens. I was lucky to be able to find a physician that was willing to work with me, and he just sort of let me, you know, do what I needed as far as tapering.
So you've mentioned tapering a number of times. I imagine that involves pharmacists as well, beyond just the physician. So can you tell me a little bit more about how to taper, what that looks like, what typically works in that process of coming off benzodiazepines?
Yeah, that's a good question. Tapers should be individualized to the patient and the symptoms that they're experiencing. So a subset of patients are going to be able to taper off fairly rapidly, while others of us, like what I experienced, it was very difficult. We have to make very tiny reductions. I think the Ashton Manual is probably a good starting point. Heather Ashton was a British psychopharmacologist, and she ran a withdrawal clinic for benzodiazepines in the 80s and 90s. And she wrote this manual, which has basically a summary of her clinical experience and helping these patients coming off the medications. And there's protocols for coming off the various benzodiazepines. She generally recommends you switch over to the Valium because it's longer half-life and because of its lower potency, you're able to get smaller reductions. And but even with that being said, her protocol is considered to be fairly slow, but I had to go even slower, and I ended up using a technique about halfway through my taper called micro taper, where I was making these very tiny reductions using a scale, and that I was able to, you know, make my withdrawal symptoms more tolerable that way. But, you know, again, this is going to be a very individualized process, and I think that's it's best if it's patient-led, so the patient is deciding when to make the reductions and, you know, how much based on the symptoms they're experiencing.
Yeah, and certainly I think it reinforces the need for patience, that you need to take this slow and that you'll get there, but not to do it too quickly. Well, thank you so much for all this great information, Dr. Christy Huff, cardiologist and director of the Benzodiazepine Information Coalition. Thanks for being on Modern Minds today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Dr. Christy Huff for chatting with me today. We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I'm going to bring us back to my conversation with Dr. Mark Horowitz. We've got much more with him. I'm Mark Hennick. This is Modern Minds.
Mental health is health. At the Institute of Living, we are pioneers in mental health. And we have been for 200 years. We have an ambition to transform mental health services while co-designing these services with those whom we serve. Together, we can reduce stigma, address discrimination, and increase access to care.
Welcome back to Modern Minds. I'm Mark Hennick. Here's the continuation of my chat with Dr. Mark Horowitz on deprescribing. Can you maybe tell us a bit about some of the motivations that somebody might want to deprescribe and how they can go about having that conversation with their doctor?
So the reasons why people would like to stop medication in surveys and in patients that I've seen, the number one reason is people want their emotions back. They feel that being on antidepressants causes numbing of their emotions. That is, both negative and positive emotions are squashed. They're less intensity. Some people experience that effect of antidepressants as being very relieving in the short term. They often start medications, you know, in the throes of panic or anxiety or depression. And to have the emotions turned down from a 9 to a 3 is experienced as a relief. In the long term, it has consequences for people because we don't have medications that are so brilliant. They just target negative thoughts. They target all emotions that we have. And so people lose interest in life, excitement. It affects their relationships. And so that's the number one reason people want to come off these medications. Other reasons are different side effects or adverse effects of these drugs, which range from impairment of memory, trouble with concentration, tiredness during the day, sleep disturbance, weight gain, sexual side effects. We know that at least half of people will have sexual side effects, which include reduced libido, reduced ability to ejaculate or experience an orgasm. There are other effects like nausea that people find disturbing, and that's sometimes the reason people want to stop their medication. Other people are concerned about the long-term health effects of the medication. So there are no long-term trials of antidepressants compared to placebo, but there are studies that find that people on antidepressants compared to people who are not on antidepressants have doubled the risk of cardiovascular disease, stroke, falls, and even an early death.
Now, I mean, given the most psychiatric medications, or at least antidepressants, more than half are prescribed by GPs. They're not even prescribed by psychiatrists. So they might not, I assume they have, you know, good knowledge to prescribe that, hopefully, but maybe not as deep as another specialist would. So how does a patient talk to their doctor who, especially in psychiatry, you might get labeled as non-compliant if you don't want to take your medication? How do you have that conversation with your healthcare provider?
So you're right, more than 80% of antidepressants are prescribed by GPs in Canada and America and other places around the world. I would hope that most doctors wouldn't respond with "you're being non-compliant." I think there is general understanding that antidepressants may serve a purpose for people in the short term. So I think it's quite common for people to stop these medications. It's not some outrageous, exception to the rule. I think that I would hope that most GPs and psychiatrists would be able to have a conversation about the benefits and the harms and alternatives. So if a person wants to stop a medication, you know, they'd be talking about what the adverse effects that they're experiencing are that they don't like, what benefits they think they're getting, if any, and what alternatives they have pursued or what has changed in their life. So, you know, if someone went through a terrible period in their life after the death of a family member, things are a lot better now, you know, their emotions are a lot calmer, it would be completely sensible to consider a reduction or stopping medication.
What is the typical protocol for deprescribing, and what should patients look out for in terms of how they react to that process, assuming they move forward with it?
So the most common way, so let's say you were to go to your doctor, ask to stop your antidepressant. We know the most common way that antidepressants are stopped is over 4 weeks. We've surveyed patients, and we've also surveyed doctors. And that is because that's what the guidelines have said for many years. In America, guidelines say to stop antidepressants over a few weeks, and they've said that for the last at least 10 years. Similar in Canada, they said that for at least the last 7 years. And so most doctors will probably do the following. They will halve the dose of the drug you're on for a couple of weeks and then halve it again for another couple of weeks and then tell you to stop it. So you may go down, say, from 20 milligrams of a drug to 10, then to 5, and then to 0. We know that causes quite a large proportion of people trouble with coming off. In particular, it causes withdrawal symptoms. We know that people's brains become accustomed to the drugs over time. You adapt to the drug. That's what causes tolerance effects and what's often described as physical dependence, which is different from addiction. It's just the process of adaptation to the drug that happens with repeated use. For example, you know, it happens with caffeine. If we drink a cup of coffee every day, our brain becomes accustomed to it. And if we stop the drug, we experience withdrawal symptoms. And often people will experience withdrawal symptoms when they stop antidepressants very quickly over a few weeks. And those withdrawal symptoms can include both emotional symptoms and physical symptoms. And the emotional symptoms involve things like anxiety, depressed mood, trouble sleeping, panic attacks, crying spells, sometimes feeling suicidal. As you can see from the list of psychological symptoms, anxiety, depressed mood, it's very easy for people to mistake those symptoms for a return of their underlying condition. And but we know that both doctors and patients are prone to do that. And so a very common story will be, doctor says, come off these drugs over a few weeks. The patient turns up, can't sleep, I feel terrible. And the doctor says, well, you must have experienced a return of your condition. This shows you must need the medication. You better go back on it. And you might even need to use it, for the rest of your life. We now know that it's very common for people to experience withdrawal effects. We know that at least half of people will do so when they stop it. And because we know that those symptoms overlap with the symptoms of depression and anxiety, doctors and patients need to be very careful that they're not experiencing withdrawal symptoms. And so if they do, rather than concluding they must need the medication, if people experience withdrawal symptoms on stopping, it really means they need to stop the drugs more slowly. And so there's been an innovation in how antidepressants are stopped in England, which hasn't filtered out the rest of the world yet. And that involves really doing three things when stopping medication. One, doing it at a rate that a patient can tolerate. So it's very hard to say there's a one-size-fits-all, everyone should come off over this number of weeks or months. You have to adjust the rate to what someone can tolerate. That's in the guidelines now in England. The second thing is doing it gradually. And gradually means for long-term users, that's people who've been on the drugs for more than a few months, coming off over months and sometimes more than a year and sometimes even a few years, because it can take that long for people to readapt to less drug being about. And so we know that weeks of tapering is too quick for most long-term users. And the third aspect is coming down in what's been called a hyperbolic pattern, which means going down by smaller and smaller amounts of the drug as you get to lower doses. And this is required because very small doses of antidepressants have very large effects on the brain. So rather than it being a straight line where doubling dose doubles the effect on the brain, we know that these drugs have a hyperbolic shape in terms of effect on the brain. Very small doses have very large effects, and the effects flatten out at higher doses. In the meantime, what has happened is patients have worked out that doctors don't know well how to stop these drugs, and they've exited healthcare and ended up on online peer support sites to get advice on how to come off these drugs. And so you know, for this sort of peculiar circumstance where people are getting more helpful advice on private Facebook songs than from their doctors, there really needs to be an upskilling and increased education of doctors in Canada and America.
In the meantime, do you think, are there effective peer support groups or other sort of support networks that people can rely on to deal with some of the effects of deprescribing?
Normally, the advice I'd give is go and ask an informed doctor, and that is always going to be the best port of call. It can be very hard to find such a doctor, and in the meantime, there are a variety of peer support sites that can be helpful to people. They're on, you know, people have these groups on Facebook. There are groups like Reviving the Antidepressants and the Withdrawal Project up online, and all of these places can be useful sources of education that people can bring to their doctors in order to educate their doctors, in order to get support about how to rock this process.
Dr. Mark Horowitz, thank you so much for coming on Modern Minds and talking with me about this controversial, but I think very important topic. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much to Dr. Mark Horowitz and Dr. Christy Huff for joining me on this episode of Modern Minds. Whether you're a patient or a provider of mental health care, I hope that we gave you lots to think about on the important topic of deprescribing. I'd like to ask you to share this episode with anyone you think might benefit from it. And if some quotes or clips stand out to you, tag me and let me know on social media. I'm at Mark Hennick, that's at MarkHennick on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. We've also got lots more thought-provoking episodes just like this one to come. We have topics like electroconvulsive therapy and more on the chemical imbalance hypothesis that you heard a bit about from Mark Horowitz today. In the meantime, please go back and check out some of the other conversations that we've had so far. We've talked about recovery, architecture, teen mental health, psychedelics, and we've got plenty more to come. Every single episode is available in both audio and video on Spotify and YouTube, so go to the show on either of those platforms to get notified as soon as the next one is up. And we also have audio-only episodes on all of the usual podcast platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon, Audible, iHeartRadio, so many others. If you've got ideas for future topics or guests, get in touch with me on my social channels at Mark Hennick or on my website, markhennick.com, and send me a message there. I look forward to hearing from you and to talking with you again next time. Until then, I'm Mark Hennick, and this has been Modern Minds.